Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another great Saturday. We have Pure Suspense Radio. We are back and better than ever. When you hear a little ELO fire on high, you know that it's time to get going. I'm your host, John Robb. We have a fabulous show for you today, 90 minutes of nothing but nonstop action with three fabulous authors. First, we're going to have coming up here John Rector, then Jamie Frevoletti, and we're going to end it with our friend Tasha Alexander, who's been on the show before, who now we got coming back. So it's time to sit back, relax, and enjoy, because an hour and 30 minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. Back with everybody here. I know we've been off a couple weeks. We're going to only have a couple shows coming up for the remainder of the year. We got one in November, a couple in December. Tomorrow, we're going to be doing a Halloween special, second annual Halloween special. I'm going to be posting on Facebook which stories I'm going to be reading. It's an hour-long show where I'm going to sit there, pick out three great stories, maybe four, depending. Read them live on the air. You can play them later, listen to them how you want to do. But it's just another great way to just, you know, get some frights and sights and everything going on for Monday when all those little trick-or-treaters come to your door. So, and I will say one thing, I'm not even getting paid for this, but you hear my little Alice Cooper intro on there. If you're an Alice Cooper fan, or even if you're not, go out and pick up Welcome to My Nightmare 2, because you're talking a fabulous album that he did just not too long ago. And the guy is, you know, pushing, I think he's in the 60s and still putting out great music. Check out Alice Cooper, Welcome to My Nightmare 2. Even if you don't like him, you'll like him with this one. So I'm just letting you know on that one. Just a little tidbit, dying off books, but hey, it's still suspense. So, but right now, I want to introduce our first guest to you, John Rector, who is the author of Already Gone, a book that was just come out here just last week. And, you know, John is one of those, and for those of you who don't know, too, Amazon is now having a couple publishing imprints, and John is one of those authors that's on that Amazon Thomas Mercer imprint, and they also just launched their 47 North, which is going to be more dark urban science fiction horror side. But John is an author on the Thomas Mercer side, which is a suspense mystery thriller books. So, John, welcome to the show, and how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
So, Already Gone, coming off the success of The Grove, which is great because, you know, that reached number one in the Amazon Top 100 at one time. And now you have to follow up that success with Already Gone. So how is the book? Can you give her a little bit of, you know, a little bit of background information on it and, you know, how it's going?
Yeah, sure. This is my third novel. It came out on Tuesday. It's called Already Gone, and it's about a college professor who has sort of a troubled crime past, and he's attacked one night after a meeting outside of a bar and has his ring finger cut off. And he tries to convince himself that it was just a random attack and no big deal, but then his wife ends up disappearing, and he realizes that maybe it wasn't just random and that maybe his past is coming back to get him. So he ends up falling back into his shady past and with a bunch of shady other characters from his past in order to find his wife. It's kind of a plot-twisty Hitchcock type of novel.
Now, the thing I always like, because, you know, I'm starting to write, but I've been thinking about it for a long time. I have many different ideas in my head, just like you probably had many different ideas. And seeing as how this is your third book, you know, was this a book that you had in your head for a long time that you finally were able to get out? Or was it something that was kind of the spur of the moment that maybe you saw a new story or you saw something that kind of hit you and you kind of twisted it into a different way? How did that thing kind of progress with you with Already Gone?
With Already Gone, it was kind of different from the other two. It was I had the opening two or three chapters for Already Gone for 6 months, I think, before I knew what to do with the book. It's almost like with me, I'll get a glimpse of something, and it won't be complete, but it'll be an image, or it'll be a character, or it'll be a scene that just won't leave me alone. And eventually, it's almost like, you know, sculpting raw clay. Eventually, it'll start to take shape, and you might see some other characters around it and things like that. And with Already Gone, that's pretty much what happened. But Already Gone is also, you know, one of the more complex novels I've done. So it took me a little longer to write this one than the others, just because there was so much there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, was it something that you had to pare down because there was so much information that you started writing and you were just like, man, I got to maybe take this down a little bit or amp this up? I mean, was that kind of your thought process going through those things?
I just wanted the book to make sense, you know, because so much stuff was going on. It just kept coming and coming and coming. And this book is very heavy on plot twists. And that's, you know, the problem with plot twists is they're great and they're fun, but they need to work, you know. And if it doesn't work, or if the continuity isn't there, then you're just, it's just going to be a mess. So that was the biggest challenge with this one, but I think it turned out all right.
Yeah, I mean, and then that's the thing that I've noticed, you know, just from writing and things like that. You know, you kind of get so far into a book, and then all of a sudden a great idea hits you that your character could do, and you're like, oh, maybe they should be doing this or doing this. And then you start to write it, and you're like, well, wait a second, I can't have them do that because I'm having them do this at the beginning, and now this isn't going to work. And it's like, well, damn it, now I got to pick which way to go. And then you find yourself ended up rewriting a lot. And, you know, sometimes, you know, that kind of happens. I mean, I'm sure everybody falls into that trap. You feel the same way?
I do. I fell into that trap a lot more with this book than I did with the others. I'm kind of a big outliner. So I will have a book, not an entire book planned out, but I'll have the majority of a book planned out, probably the first 50% of it before I ever start writing. And then I will just keep adding on to the outline as I go. So when I'm hit with something that, oh, well, this would be great if this happens, I can kind of add it in as I'm writing. But yeah, this one was a little different. The book I think is around 75,000 words, I think, and I probably deleted about 50,000 words out of it over the course of writing it, just to get the plot and the structure of the story and the path that the characters are going to take to actually work. So it was a lot of work.
And like you mentioned, this is your third book. But now your first was kind of a little different because it was a short story collection. That was one of them. But your first was called The Cold Kiss. And you were with and the reason I'm talking is because you were with a different publisher with that one. And now you kind of ended up with the Amazon. And you mentioned on your website, which I'm going to tell everybody, is johnrector.blogspot.com to have all the information you can find out. But you mentioned something that's very interesting was it was very difficult for you to leave Tor to be able to go over to Amazon. How was that approached, and how does that, you know, kind of come about? Because a lot of authors might be struggling with, you know, how publishing is. They're afraid to maybe take certain leaps. You know, how was that thought process for you?
Leaving a major publisher to go with Amazon?
Yeah.
My story is kind of different. The Cold Kiss was my first book that was published, but The Grove was the first book I wrote. The short story collection you mentioned, those were just stories that I was writing before I ever started writing a novel that are out there. But when I sat down to write a novel, I wrote The Grove, and I found and I got an agent with it, and we sent it out to all, you know, the New York publishers, and the response was positive. But The Grove doesn't really fit into a genre. It's not a horror novel. It's not a mystery novel, but it is, kind of, you know. So they didn't know what to do with it. Plus, they, you know, finding a new writer that they don't know what to do with, even if they like them, it's never going to pass the marketing department. You know, they have to be able to pigeonhole you. So I ended up putting The Grove in the trunk and forgetting about it and writing The Cold Kiss, and I tried to stay more focused with the crime noir suspense genre with that one. Before Tor came calling, I decided to release The Grove myself as an ebook. And so I released it on Amazon as an ebook, but within 2 days, I think, Tor had come calling, so I really didn't need to do that. But I was lucky that I did, because it caught the attention of Amazon. And so while I was waiting for the Tor novel to be published, The Grove was selling so well as an Amazon ebook that I got a call from one of the editors at Amazon Encore asking me if they could republish the book. And at the time, I had just sold The Grove to Simon & Schuster in the UK as part of a three-book deal with The Cold Kiss, The Grove, and a third novel, which turned out to be already gone. And I wanted The Grove published in the U.S., but I didn't know anything about Amazon. But I ended up taking a chance with them, and it ended up being the best decision I ever made. I think Amazon is fantastic, and as much as I love Tor, Amazon is just perfect, especially for a newer writer coming out, because first of all, they have such a wide reach to the reading public, and they can just get your book out there in front of people.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that a lot of people are wondering, is because Amazon is quite arguably, I would say, you know, they don't have the stable that, you know, like the HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster does, but they are definitely the company that has the bigger, like you said, the bigger reach, because they're worldwide. They're the largest bookstore in the world by far, and now they're starting to publish, and you're kind of jumping on this journey with them together, so you might be teaching them a couple things. They might be teaching you a couple things, so that, you know, that train's got to be interesting alone from just that point to go on.
It's very exciting. You know, I use the analogy, it's like being with a very hip, very cool indie publisher that just wants to try new things and wants to be creative and just wants to do whatever they can possibly do to sell books, to get people reading, to really, you know, get out there. Except this indie publisher has very, very deep pockets, and they can afford to do this stuff, and they have the way to do it. And, you know, going back to your question about leaving Tor for Amazon, Tor made an offer for Already Gone, a good offer, better than the offer they made for The Cold Kiss, but it was a hard decision because, you know, that's the dream, you know. I don't know about you, but I grew up reading these books, going to the bookstore, and these are the big publishers, the big New York publishers, and to sort of turn your back on that and say, well, I'm going to try something new, even as logical as it sounds, it's still a little difficult, and I think that's where some people, you know, have that problem. But ever since I did, I've had absolutely no reservations about leaving now. I couldn't have made a better choice.
And, you know, we have a lot of authors that that listen to the show, along with a lot of inspiring authors that are brand new, so we kind of got a good range. And the one thing I always like to know is, you know, when you started, you had different, you know, you probably had a different idea of how it was going to be. And now that you're kind of into it now with three books, and you've been through the process, and you kind of know how it goes and things like that, how has it been changing for you, you know, since your first book to now Already Gone, and now you're more of a household name? You know, how has it changed career-wise and maybe personal-wise for you going forward?
I know when I got the Tor deal for The Cold Kiss, you're just trying to find your place. You know, it's funny because before you actually get a book published, and at least with me, I was writing a lot of short stories, and all of my writer friends were also struggling, and nobody had agents, nobody had book deals. And I think I was the first of all my friends to that weren't already published to actually publish and get a book deal. And so what was sort of shocking at the time is when you move to that next level, everybody has a book deal. Everybody is, like, just struggling for attention. And so it's like, it's almost like you go from being a big fish in a small pond to being a small fish in a gigantic pond.
Right.
And so that was different. But since then, now that I have the third book come out, I'm noticing that people like almost like bring me into the fold a little bit more. It's like, okay, he's been here for a little while now. You know, we're going to actually pay attention to this guy. You know, before I was just sort of the new guy over there in the corner at the conventions and stuff like that. But this time, you know, I get put on panels. People I don't know come up and talk to me with my books and stuff. And so that's kind of neat. But other than that, it's all pretty much the same. You still have to sit down and do the work, so.
Yeah, and the work is the part, you know, that I would think is the most fun, is being able to sit down and just use your thoughts and sit there and just creatively just, you know, just write things out? Because I would have to think that you probably have three books, you know, running around in your head right now.
At least, yeah. At least.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm working on the fourth right now, and I've got a couple novellas that I'm going to be doing this year, and I also want to start writing short stories again, but, you know, we'll see. There's always more ideas.
Yeah, and have you thought of, you know, doing anything, you know, because your books are, all standalones.
Right.
And so have you thought of, you know, creating a character series, or is that something that you don't even want to get involved with? Because some people, and I've heard the arguments on both sides, and when you start writing a character series, it's almost like your creative side kind of goes away a little bit, because now you start, after like three or four books, you're almost more formula writing and you're not really, you know, creatively writing. And I see that argument where, you know, on the other side, if you're continually doing standalones, you have to continually push yourself to make the best, you know, possible work that you can, because you're really putting yourself out there every single time when you do a standalone book. Because if you write one that's not taken that well, you have to kind of climb yourself back up that ladder again.
Yeah, you're only as good as your last book, kind of thing. I've thought about doing. I have a couple ideas for some series characters that I'd like to explore, but I can't really see myself doing novel length. Novel-length series character books. I'm thinking about maybe starting out with some novellas and just seeing how they're taken and what people think about them. But, you know, I just love standalones. I love being able to just go into a different world every time and do something different. But you never know. I've never tried it, and I'd be up for it. You know, and I have a pretty cool idea for them. So you never know.
Would it be a character that you've written about or that you're thinking about that, I mean, that's just gotten you right now, or you haven't really, or that hasn't really crossed your thought process right now on the character side?
For the series character that I'm thinking
about? Yeah. What I'm trying to get to, you know, your fans or whatnot, because they're always clamoring, and I know you probably had things from your fans that's like, gosh, can we have another book on, you know, such and such character, or, you know, this character in your book would be a great person to write more about. Do you get those types of things from your fans?
I do. I've gotten that with the Cold Kiss. Everybody wants, you know, talks about the ending and wants to know more, and I've gotten that with one of the characters in Already Gone named Gabby. Everybody wants me to expand on him. And mm-hmm. I might, you know, I've thought about, you know, taking the characters from The Cold Kiss and maybe clarifying them in future books. But I don't know. I don't know if I'll ever revisit any of those characters again. You know, they are what they are. So.
And so I want to remind everybody here, we're speaking with author John Rector. His website is John Rector. blogspot.com. The latest book, which you said just came out Tuesday, is called Already Gone. It's available through, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, wherever you can find. I would suggest getting it as an e-reader just because I love e-books, and you can download it right now as you're listening. So that's something that you want to check out. Now, coming back here, you know, from The Grove, as you were number one, which was probably totally unexpected. Would that be correct in saying that?
Yeah, very. Very unexpected.
And so, you know, when you, and like I said, so when you reach kind of that level and you're like, gosh, you know, what was the pressure like for you then when you were writing the book Already Gone, on that aspect alone of the pressure of, Jesus, can I match that, you know, kind of success now that I've had, and what are people going to think, you know, if when it comes out? Did you have a little bit more level of anticipation with the kind of, you know, a little more anxiety when it was coming out?
Oh, that book was anxiety from the start. I mean, and what it comes down to is, you know, when I wrote The Grove, one of my best friends is a guy named Sean Doolittle, who's a writer in the same town that I live in, and I'd always bounce questions off him. He publishes with Random House, and so when I was writing, and he always told me, enjoy this right now because you can write whatever you want. You know, you don't. you don't even have to worry about what people think. You're just doing this on your own. So I wrote The Grove, and there was no pressure. I wrote The Cold Kiss, and there was no pressure. But then The Cold Kiss got published, then The Grove got published while I was writing Already Gone, and the reviews start coming in, and you start getting emails from fans, and, you know, you start realizing that people are out there talking about you. And meanwhile, when you're writing a book, and I don't care who you are, most people, when they're halfway through a book, or there comes a point when you're just like, this is garbage. You know, no matter what the book is, you hate whatever it is you're writing. I think that's just
right.
A natural part of the process. So to have that feeling about this book you're writing, coupled with all these great reviews that you're getting for these other books, and that expectation of what's this new book going to be, it creates sort of this tsunami of just self-doubt and anxiety about, oh, you know, especially because Already Gone is a slight departure from the other books. And so, yeah, it was like that a lot. I mean, I'm just now, the book's been out for a week, and I'm just now starting to calm down about it, I guess.
And do you have a big tour? I mean, is there events that people can see you on, get their book signed, you know, meet you in person? Are you doing any events maybe near your area or any place else around?
I'm not doing any right now. I was going to be in the Pacific Northwest. I might do some around the first of the year. You know, I'm gonna try to go down to Phoenix, to the Poison Pen. I'm gonna try to go down to Houston, and then, you know, maybe to Minneapolis in the spring, and then just conventions this year. You know, hit stores in those places.
And you know, people always like to know. So you're kind of, you booked maybe a little bit for next year with like Left Coast Crime and VoucherCon and Thriller Fest and things of those nature. Is that a good place where people can catch you out next year?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sure I'll be at Thriller Fest. I'll definitely be at VoucherCon. Left Coast Crime I haven't signed up for yet, but I would love to go. So I just need to get in touch with them. And I'll be hitting all the conventions. So, and I'll post everything on my blog, too, where I'll be or if I do have any signings coming up.
Now, here's a new question that I also started to ask writers, because I want them to kind of think. And James Rollins actually had told me this question and thought that it was one of the best ones he had heard. And so I wanted to see from you, is there a scene or maybe just a sentence in any one of your books that you kind of wrote and said, man, I nailed that one, or you go back and say, I cannot believe I wrote that? Is there something in one of your books that, you know, because it was like, oh, my God, did I literally just write The Ship Rocked and Rolled and it was a dark and stormy night? It's like, you know, something like that. But, you know, do you have that? Did you have, like, a scene or something that just absolutely clicked and you thought it was one of the best things that, you know, one of the best scenes or sentences, literally, that you've ever written, or maybe vice versa?
I definitely have sentences and even scenes in the books that I go back to because I like them. I don't know if I'm just blocking the bad stuff or not, but I'm really a perfectionist as far as I'll sit for a day and focus on one sentence. So I don't have too many that slip by me that I absolutely hate just because I won't let them. But yeah, there's some good stuff in The Grove and in The Cold Kiss and in Already Gone that I'll come back to and be like, yeah, that really works. That's really cool. But, you know, I don't really read the books too much after I'm done with them. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I was kind of wanting to know, Lord, if you give me like a specific scene that you wrote that said, and you don't have to give it away, but you could say, okay, and, you know, in Already Gone, there's a scene in here that I think it's absolutely the most important scene in the book where it either twists, turns, does whatever, and that's the one that you think that you really nailed it in that, just in that part that you think is like the, is like one of those, I'm trying to find the word, but it's like one of those, you know, those scenes is just like that's the one that cultivates the whole book right there in that little part, in that maybe three pages.
I think, and Already Gone, I think the opening chapter of Already Gone is really good, but there's a scene in Already Gone between the main character, Jake, and Gabby, where they're talking on Gabby's roof where he's raising birds. He raises racing pigeons, and that conversation and just how that scene unfolds and where it leads from, as a, you know, and where it leads to as a transitional scene, I think works really, really good. In The Grove, there's a scene with some ants that I love, and in the Cold Kiss, the final chapter I really like, and how it ties the book together, but that one's a little controversial because that's either a love-hate kind of ending. So some people love it, some
love
people
that?
Hate it.
And don't you love that you that you get either reaction? Either reaction is great, isn't it?
Well, the very first signing I ever did was here in town, and the very first person who ever came up to me at my very first signing handed me the book and said, "I absolutely loved your book. I hate your ending." So that was kind of the start. But then, you know, I think later I had a girl come up and told me the ending made her cry. So it's either one way or the other. They either hate it or they like it.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, John, you know, we wish you nothing but success. It has been fabulous having you on here today. Everybody, John Rector, the book is already gone. It's johnrector.blogspot.com. And, you know, can people email you, too? Is your email address? Everything I see is on here. If they have any questions and just want to say hi or want to give you feedback on the book.
Absolutely. It's john@thecoldkiss.com. That's my email address.
Okay, so people can give you any kind of information, whether they, like you said, whether they love it or hate it or anything else, that they can just let
you
know.
That's what they do.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, thanks again so much for coming on, and we will look for you at these events, because we're going to be at a couple of them next year, like Left Coast, maybe not VoucherCon, because we're not maybe real big fans of Albany, but we'll probably definitely be at Thriller Fest, because we like that one. Or not really Albany, I think it's Cleveland.
Cleveland this year, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I'm from Ohio, and I'm not calling back. So, but hey, it's been great to have you on, and I appreciate it. So we will talk with you soon.
Sounds great. Thank you very much.
All right, have a good one.
You too.
So again, everybody, that was author John Rector, and the book is called Already Gone, and it is available right now. It is it's not a sequel. I'm just saying it's the next book after the most popular book here in the Grove, which hit 100 on the top paid sellers in the Kindle store. So John Rector is one of those ones that you're going to be looking for. It's his third book that's been out. So it's johnrector.blogspot.com to find out all the information that you want to. Just go there, and it'll have it for you. We're going to be right back here with our next guest, Jamie Frevoletti. And she's going to talk about her latest book called The Ninth Day. So stick around. You don't want to miss it. And in the meantime, here you go. those of you who might not know, that is the great band Y&T with a little Contagious. Thought I'd change it up a little bit, play a little something different here coming off from break, because we're going to come right here with our next guest, which is author Jamie Frevoletti. Hopefully I said that name correct, because you know I'm not very good on last names. So, Jamie, your book, The Ninth Day, is out. How you doing? What's going on?
Hi, John. My book's out. It's great. I'm doing wonderful. And I have to say that The Ninth Day is one of my, probably, which is becoming one of my favorite novels, only because it is a start to, you know, from beginning to end, action, adventure, tale, which I love.
And, you know, this is, this is your third book. This is your third book in the series where it's your character,
Emma
Caldridge.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and it's a little different because I can't really remember, and you know, I see a lot of different books, a lot of different characters, but she's a biochemist, which is something that's different. Do you have that? Is there a background with you in your real life compared to this life with that? Because I've just never seen a biochemist as a main character, which I find fascinating. I love that.
Yeah, you know, there is a little bit of background. I used to be a lawyer. I did food, drug, and medical device defense. The Salmonella trials here in Chicago, I was on the defense. They got Salmonella in the milk here many years ago. Breast implant cases, anything involving food, drug, and medical devices. So when it came time to do a protagonist, I wanted her to be kind of a scientist because that's pretty much who I dealt with day in, day out, my expert witnesses. And, a lot of the pharmaceutical companies that I dealt with. So, you know, she was kind of a perfect fit for that. And Emma Caldridge is kind of this, you know, brainy athlete who is always curious and always applying, you know, some scientific principle to something that's happening to her. It's really a lot of fun to write.
Yeah, so the book, The Ninth Day, and we're coming here, like we said, this is book three. Can you give us a little bit about the progression not only of Emma, but also, you know, a little bit inside of the book and maybe the progression of how you have been from a writer coming from Running from the Devil, which was the first novel with Emma Caldridge, to now The Ninth Day, which is the third book.
Yeah, sure. Well, Emma, the first is Running from the Devil. If you want to read them in order for people who are listening, the first is Running from the Devil, the second is Running Dark, and now the third is The Ninth Day. In Running from the Devil, that was my debut novel. That's the one that won several awards, and I really feel like Emma in that novel, she's down in the Colombian jungle. She's thrown free when the paramilitary group that downs the plane, she gets thrown free, and she ends up tracking them as they collect the other people hostage, and she tracks them through the jungle. Now, in that book, she was unable to shoot a gun. She has guns. She can shoot them. She collects guns, but along the way. But she knows that if she tries to shoot a gun, someone else, one of the paramilitary guys, is probably going to be faster and quicker at it because she's never actually shot one. She does have access to them. So in that book, she couldn't shoot. In Running Dark, she's there's a cruise liner overtaken by Somali pirates, and there's a drug in the cargo hold of the cruise liner, and she has to go infiltrate it. In that one, she's taught by an actual COT pilot, a pilot who runs the COT drug trail through Africa. Those are actual trails. They're actual flights. And it's legal. Mm-hmm. COT is legal. She learns how to shoot a rocket-propelled grenade. So in the book number three, she's very different. You know, she's now working part-time for the contract security company, and she actually knows how to shoot a couple of weapons, and she's a little bit of a different person.
And so was that kind of the progression of Emma that you saw coming, or did she decide this is what I'm going to do, and she's kind of done it on her own, with the progression coming up here with The Ninth Day?
You know, in The Ninth Day, what I really wanted to go for was kind of a classic action-adventure novel, more like a North by Northwest, you know, one of my favorite movies. I wanted to have an actual person, a real person in unusual circumstances, slowly learn from what goes on around them how to handle something. And so that's what Emma does. You know, she's in the desert. She's collecting night-blooming plants. It's what she does for her living. She does biochemistry, so a lot of botany is involved. And she comes across human traffickers, and they drag her across the border to Ciudad Juarez, and the plants are dying. And the cartel leader knows that she knows a lot about plants and, you know, orders her. The plants will kill the plants and other people. It's transferring to humans in 9 days, and he gives her 9 days to solve the problem. And what I liked about it is there's a time deadline, obviously. Classic thriller, you know.
Right.
Classic thriller time deadline, which you kind of need in some thrillers. And I also like the fact that, you know, the cartel leaders, I don't want to make it a spoiler, but the cartel leader believes that it's from herbicide dusting that we do on the marijuana fields in Mexico. We do drop a very highly potent herbicide. It's not paraquat anymore, which I guess an old Vietnam vet told me they used to do paraquat on the marijuana fields, but it's a different type of drug. And he thinks that's what's killing them, and he's going to load them up on a ship and run them through America to try and stop it. Because if it doesn't get stopped, he feels he won't, you know, his trade is over. His fields are dead. And so she has to stop that. And I really wanted to go in this novel with her on this trek, this really interesting trek where she's actually tasked to try and, you know, solve this problem. And I kind of go through the underbelly of Mexico and then up through the marijuana route, actually the echo route that runs through America. And, you know, she takes stopping points along the way, and it's kind of interesting.
Well, you know, what you're doing is, you know, you're bringing in a very real-life situation, of course, with the drug cartels in Mexico and the violence that's going on down there. I will say that I believe it's a crime to kill marijuana plants. Put that out there right now. But I think that's the real crime in the whole situation. But that's but my political views are beside the point. But you know,
it's funny because the marijuana trade in America, you know, you would think it's kind of benign. I hate to use that term with regard to it, but kind of benign.
Yeah.
You think, well, you know, who's going to kill over marijuana? My God, when I started researching, it's very lucrative, and wherever there's money to be made, there are evil people willing to kill others for it. It's really kind of, you know, human nature to me that's a little bit surprising and awful. So I really did track the route. The route does start in Arizona, runs through kind of Midwest up to Chicago, where I live, and then it continues on to Baltimore and Washington, D.C.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, 80% of all drug-related busts in the United States are all marijuana-related.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Very popular.
But,
and, you know, you would think it's benign. You actually would think it's benign, but I guess the people who are, the gangs are getting onto it, wherever, like I say, when there's money to be made, the gangs will be there. And,
yeah.
You know, it's quite dangerous to deal with them. They are not normal. They don't think the way we think. They're not logical. You can't talk them out of what they're going to do. And when I was reading about them, I thought, it's kind of frightening for someone like me who always thinks, well, I'll just explain to him. You know, you can't kill off these people. They're your customers. But, you know, they don't care who they kill. So,
no.
You know, when
no,
you read about
don't.
It, it's really quite shocking.
Yeah, and, you know, and again, I'm just going to do my little political rant. If you want to stop all the violence and the stuff on the marijuana trade, just make it legal. Because then, guess what? They have nothing to fight over. Because you can go down to the 7-Eleven and go pick it up and do whatever you got to do, and you're just squeezing the life out of them. But again,
actually, there's a very funny thing you should look at. We're getting off the subject a little bit, but I do want to tell you this very funny thing. I think it's called
yeah.
Big Bang Theory, the movie,
uh-huh.
the television show.
Yeah.
They have one about legalizing marijuana. They did a little skit on it, and it is absolutely hysterical. I saw it on a Facebook link, sadly, of my teenage son, so I'm going to have to talk to him. But it's a hysterical Big Bang Theory, which is one of his favorite television shows.
Yeah.
So if anyone's listening, apparently they do a very funny kind of satire on the whole thing.
Well, what I was trying to get into, where, you know, with the whole marijuana and everything and the relevancy of everything going on today with the drug cartels, and, of course, you know, I'm from California, so... in Southern California, you know, that's always a fear is how far up the drug cartels come in Los Angeles
yeah.
and San Diego and places like that. And they're very popular, of course, on the Texas border, Arizona border, New Mexico borders. Did you literally have to go down and see those things firsthand? Did you put yourself in the line of fire, or did you kind of do your research a little bit more from afar?
Well, you know, I've been in I went to Columbia for the first one. And the second one was Somalia. Couldn't do that. I was on Google Earth while I was emailing a journalist from the Chicago Tribune who was in Somalia to help me in Berbera, Somalia. And, you know, we were kind of coordinating that. I've been to Mexico so many times that mm-hmm. I could have gone down to see a dad. And, I had relatives who crossed the border fairly often because we have friends in Mexico right over the border. But I didn't this time. I just felt like... I'd been there so many times, I kind of know. And once you do the research in Ciudad, you know, Ciudad is kind of industrial and it's a tough area right now. And I just didn't feel it was necessary for me to go. So I did do this one from afar with a little bit of Google Earth and a lot of research. And honestly, it's sad. One of the articles I read was called The War Next Door, and that's kind of what's going on. And I just hate to see the criminal element taking over like that in Ciudad. It's really, really kind of shocking and horrendous. So, no, I didn't go there this time, this year, for it. I've been there in the past.
And so was there something in your research that you did find, you know, that was just overly shocking that either you did put in the book or you did not put in the book that just really grabbed your attention as something that's like, I had no idea this, you know, this actually was going on?
Yeah, there were two things. One thing that I did not put in the book, two things that I did that really shocked the heck out of me. The first was that they had recently uncovered 72 bodies buried in a mass grave right over the border. And that's in the book. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe that you could go across the border, and I can't even imagine that. And then the other thing was, I think we all have read about where they were in the dance club and they threw 9 heads on the dance floor. That was a few years ago now. That's been about, you know, you write these books a year in advance. So that was about 2 years ago. And that's what started me thinking about Mexico. I mean, something like that in a dance club is horrific. The thing I did not put in the book because it was too late, and I'm glad I didn't, was I had been reading about how they close off the intersections. What they'll do is they'll drive a bunch of trucks into an intersection, say downtown Chicago, or if you're in California, downtown L.A., and they'll block off the intersections. And they do it strategically so the cops can't come, and then they start killing people, literally standing in the street and just starting to kill people who drive up. And I did that about a year ago, or no, about 4 months ago. And that's pretty shocking to me. And the reason they close it off, they create such gridlock that the cops can't get there in time. So, you know, we're talking about broad daylight, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. They do it during rush hour. I mean, it's the kind of level of violence that I don't think that we in America really could kind of comprehend. I didn't put it in the book because I don't think people would have believed it. And sometimes you can't write truth in a book.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it just is too crazy.
I know.
Well, that's kind of where I was with that.
So would you consider your book, and I'm reminding everybody, we're speaking here with author Jamie Frevolati. Her website is Jamie Frevolati, FreveLetti.com. So would you consider your latest book here, The Ninth Day, the third book in the Emma Caldwell's Coleridge series, is this probably one of your most fast-paced, fast-paced actual more thriller, just downright dead thriller, you know, page-turning from page to page with Emma and her adventure?
Absolutely. I write a lot of, I write page-turners, but this one I really kind of got obsessed myself. I mean, I was spending hours every day writing it just because I loved it. Yeah, the pace on this one is really, really good. Now, for those of you who are listening, I'm working on another thing. My goal, and the readers will tell me if it's possible or not, but my goal is to try and get kind of the feeling you got from the movie Speed. Remember, you couldn't go below 55 or the bus would blow up? Well, I kind of kept that in my mind for this book. Like, what I really wanted for this book is she's on a road trip, right? So you kind of have to go from place to place to place, which is why it got that page-turning feel, because, you know, it kind of fed into the storyline. And so this book, even my editor, who's been at it for about, you know, she's been in the business 15, 18 years, said that it's one of the rare times reading a manuscript of one of her authors that she actually had to stay up late to finish it, which is quite a compliment, because if you know editors in these big houses, you know, they're reading so much all day. So I knew I kind of had hit it when she called me and told me that. And this book is really that way. And I love that about it. It's not the idea I had for Speed quite yet. It does have its quiet moments, which actually it needs. And that's the problem I'm having with doing the Speed book, is most books need peaks and valleys to give the reader a breath. And so I'm trying to figure out how to get that all done. But this book has been, it's really quite nice, in fact, that it's such a, you know, bang, bang, bang thriller. I really enjoyed writing it, and I'm getting a lot of good reviews on it. And I'm also getting a lot of good reviews on a new character I wrote in it, So I'm actually considering, I'm writing number four now, and I'm actually, you know, going to, considering bringing him back in for number four, because he's gotten such good press, so to speak, so.
And, you know, I tell people, like you're saying, you know, you need those little down times. You have to think of it as like a rock concert. Is, you know, they come out blazing in the first couple songs, maybe three songs, and then they throw in that ballad where you kind of, just catch your breath in the first three songs. You kind of sit down, you know, then they have the songs in there where you put the lighters in the air and this and that. And those are the times when the real emotional part of the characters in the book really are written well.
Right.
And
I
that's
mean,
when
I do
you
think,
really have to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, I really think when you slow down a thriller, you're taking a risk every time you slow down a thriller. However, you have to have those down points. That's why I think the whole Speed project is going to be quite interesting if I could ever get it done. You may not see it in the next book. You may not see it in a few books. But because how do you slow something down within this with this hectic pace? But I do think that's important. In this book, when they come, when the lower parts come, it's usually about exactly what you say. It's about exploring a little bit further what's going on with these characters, both personally and with regard to the disease that's starting to attack everyone.
Yeah,
it's really, it's an interesting novel. I really enjoyed writing this one.
Now, do you have plans to kind of write a standalone or something different, or is Emma still the latest? You know, she's still the only one that's kind of in your brain right now that we're going to see.
You know, Emma's always in my brain. But as you know, I wrote the latest Ludlum. I was hired by the estate of Robert Ludlum to write the latest in the Covert One series. And so I've written this year alone another novel. You know, I've written other characters. So although Emma's always there and I'm writing Emma now, I think I will always have an Emma book. But, yeah, I'm certainly capable of writing standalones. And I do have the Covert One comes out next fall. Emma comes out next fall. I have two books out the same, close to the same time. And then I have other manuscripts I'm working on that I really can't go into too much detail about, but also are different, completely different characters of either of the two, those other two. So, you know, I'm always writing. It's what I do. I love it. And, you know, it just depends on when I'll have the, you know, the opening to release the next, these couple of things that I'm working on the side.
And so, kind of looking back, I mean, you know, you all of a sudden, you know, you're being contacted, like you said, you know, by Robert Ludlum, and you have all of a sudden, you know, all this stuff is happening so fast. How's that little journey, just in that little location, been from all of a sudden you're being contacted, you're writing, you're doing this, you're like, oh my God, everything's happening so fast. You're like, stop for a second.
Yeah. What I didn't realize too, you know, John. Well, as you know, I'm new. Really, really new, and a lot of people don't even know who I am yet in America. I'm very big in Europe, but you know, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, what I didn't count on, and I guess was my naivete, was once I started with the Emma thing and it hit and got all those awards, then of course you start to get people in the industry start to notice you first, of course. Because that's their job. It's their job to see who's up and coming. So they kind of take a look at all that. But what I didn't realize, too, is my speaking events and my conference events would start to also build. So while, you know, the industry does see you, all the people, kind of like you, the magazine people, everyone who's in this industry starts to know because they know first. And then they kind of put it out to their people, and then everyone else picks up. What I didn't realize is how much more marketing I would be doing, how many more conferences, and I do love them. So I try to say yes to everything I can because I love meeting people and the readers. And so that's something I have to really start plugging in a really organized fashion so I can continue to write. And that's the thing I hadn't really thought about because I always thought you could just write at the computer and then someone else would market all that stuff. But it doesn't really work that way, and honestly, I think if I did that, I would be kind of a strange person. You know, in the end, I don't know that I could live that way. So I'm very happy to get out there. So that's kind of another piece of the puzzle that I wasn't aware of when I started.
Well, here's something that's kind of off the wall. What are you handing out for Halloween?
What am I going to be?
Well, no. What kind of candy are kids going to come and get from your house? You got the Snickers, the Milky Way. Are you a chocolate or more of a non-chocolate
person? You know, the kids are getting
person.
Chocolate, man. They're getting Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. I love them. They're getting chocolate. And actually, in front of my house right now, it's kind of horrifying. We have Cotton Man or something, a Cocoon Man. You see him, they're in CVS, hanging upside down, and it's got like a knife in its chest and blood all over it. It's hanging upside down from a tree in front of my house. And I'm a little concerned. My teenage daughter put it up, and she's really bent on scaring the little kids. And I told her, that's a little horrifying, but that's what you'll see when you come to the Frevoletti household for Halloween.
And the other thing is that, do you ever consider maybe – like having some of your books and you kind of, some of the, or does any of the adults kind of walk up and say, oh, you're Jamie, and then, they kind of sign, or do you have anything like that you kind of give away to the adults?
I do get the adults who come to the house now. We had for the ninth day, we had a Subway promotion with the ninth day and the Subway cards on the brown and the red and the blue line here in Chicago, so a lot of people are starting to recognize that. And,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, my friends know where I live. I would hope that my address isn't on the web, but you never know. And one would hope, because I don't want to, become my own thriller novel. But
isn't it 3467?
Yeah,
no, I'm just joking.
Right. Put it out there, John. Just let them all come and kill me.
But
it's kind of fun. It's fun. Some people do recognize you. I would give away an ARC probably to somebody who asks. I have a couple of extra ARCs, so I would do something like that. But it's just a lot of fun. And actually for number four, I'm having Emma, who's a scientist. She's not a superhero. She's an athlete with a big intellect. But she's not a superhero. She has no superhero powers. She doesn't beat everybody up like, some of the other male characters, because she can't, and she's a female. So in number four, I have the scientist Emma meeting up with something that is on its face, not able to be answered by science. And you will see the chapter in the last, they put the first chapter in the end of the ninth day of the number four. So if you read that, you're going to see where, you're going to see something, you're going to go, whoa, where is she headed with this? And that's what it's really about. I wanted to pit the scientist against supernatural. So it actually fits for Halloween.
and that'd be something that was a little bit, that has to be a little bit more challenging, I guess, wouldn't you say?
Oh, it's huge. I really hit, at one point, I hit a real stumbling block, because there were a couple of things that I wanted to explore that science on its face couldn't explore. I did find an answer to it that science could follow it. But, yeah, it's interesting, though, how much of science has solved a lot of things. I mean, there's always two possible explanations, kind of an interesting gray area in the world that I really love, and so I'm exploring it in the novel.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And, can you kind of let people know, where you're going to be? Are you going to, do you have a big tour that's going to be lined up? Are they going to be able to come out and see you and have their book signed? Where are you going to be out, kind of out in the masses with the ninth day and kind of doing some promotion?
In the ninth day, I already did a quick tour, a kind of a hip-hop tour with Wendy Corsi Staub. We hopped to, Phoenix, Houston, some of the independent booksellers, Barnes & Noble in Dunkirk, we went to Buffalo. So we did that for a week, and then I just got off the road from the East Coast. I came all the way down the coast to Florida, ended up in Boca Raton, which I did last year. And then I think for the ninth day, these conferences that I'm talking about, I'll be at Love is Murder in Chicago. I will next week I'll be in Sea Island, Georgia at the Scribblers Writing Conference. That's going to be very interesting. And then in the winter I do the Association of Writing Professionals. I do Sleuth Fest, which is in Florida. I do Thriller Fest. So I'm going to be putting a lot more up on the webpage now. But, it's going to be kind of hip-hopping across the country, so you'll have to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, do you like writing in your blog and doing those things? I mean, do you have fun doing that?
I have fun doing that. I do The Outfit, which is a collective of crime writers. I do The Outfit blog, and I have a little journal page on my website, which I put up whatever I'm thinking about. It doesn't have to have any particular – it's sometimes about writing. Recently, I think I was writing about a historical novel – that I read that is really amazing, but just kind of came to mind, and so that's on there.
Yeah.
I like doing that. I do try to keep it up about every couple of weeks or so. And, you know, I just, I enjoy writing. So that's kind of where I am and with everything.
Well, Jamie, we want to thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. I'm sure we'll be able to meet you because we haven't met you in person yet in some of these events. I mean, I don't know if we just keep missing or what, but we'll probably be in Thriller Fest and Left Coast Crime and maybe BoucherCon.
Even though I'm going to be in Cleveland, John.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I won't be in BoucherCon, but we'll be at I'm not going to Cleveland. There's no way. I'm from Ohio. I grew up in Columbus. Oh, I hate Cleveland. I'm not going to the Mistake on the Lake. There's just no way.
You're not going, huh? Okay.
No, not to the Mistake on the Lake. I gotta wait. I mean, I was trying to tell BoucherCon, you know what? Why don't we just have a nice 5-city tour where you do LA, Chicago, Miami, New York, and like Dallas, and maybe add in like a Seattle, maybe do 6 cities, because then that way, you know, everybody kind of has a chance. It's kind of all over, but it's always in a nice big city. There's a lot of stuff to do because it's Cleveland. There's no LeBron. There's nothing there no more. It's gone. Okay? There's nothing to do. The flats are now flat. There's nothing to do.
Well, then I'll see you at Thriller Fest.
We'll see you at Thriller Fest. So thanks a lot, Jamie. You have a good one.
Thank you, too. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was Jamie Favreletti. The book is called The Ninth Day. It's available now. You can go to her website, jamiefrevoletti.com. Freveletti is her last name, .com, and check out the book, The Ninth Day. We're going to be back in 2 minutes with our last guest here, the wonderful Tasha Alexander. So in the meantime, here you go. I don't know about you guys, but I could literally sit here and sing Benny Mardoon's Into the Night, but I'm not going to, because that's not what you want to hear. No, What we're all here and what we want to hear is our next guest, which is the fabulous Tasha Alexander with her latest book in the Lady Emily series, number 6, A Crimson Warning. We would love to welcome back Tasha to the show. Tasha, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm great, John. It's great to be talking to you again.
Yeah, and we're into book 6 now, Crimson Warning. For people who do not know, you create something that's very unique because your books are set in Victoria, London, and, you know, you have that aspect of having to go back, which makes it a challenge in itself, just to have to write in today's aspect back into Victorian time. And, you know, with Lady Emily, with her mysteries and everything that's going on. So tell us a little bit about Crimson Warning.
Well, Crimson Warning, the idea for Crimson Warning came to me because I'd been thinking a lot about secrets. I think most of us have something that we'd really prefer that no one else knew about us. Everybody's got a secret. And
yes,
I wanted to think about what happens when people know that that deep, dark secret that they don't want anyone to know about is about to be exposed. Because, you know, people behave very differently. You know, if you knew, if you had been put on notice that your deep, dark secret was about to be exposed, would you confess preemptively? Would you take radical action to try to be able to deny it? Do you commit suicide? What do you do? So I was thinking a lot about that. And I was thinking also about social inequality, which, you know, and it's funny because when I was writing this book, things weren't quite as bad here as they are now in terms of you know, financial situations and social inequality. But certainly in Victorian London, you know, you've got these incredibly wealthy aristocrats. And then you've got the working class who can barely get by, who are living in abject poverty in the most appalling circumstances. And I, you know, part of the reason I'd started the series was because I wanted to explore what makes an aristocratic young woman who's in a perfectly comfortable situation start to be an instrument for social change.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say that this is maybe one of your, you know, most emotional situations that you put Lady Emily into with the Crimson Warning?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, in the earlier books in the series, she undergoes intellectual awakening. She starts to see a broader view of the world. She, for the first time, associates with people who aren't of her social class, who aren't her own servants.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've lived a very comfortable, easy life, and in such a sheltered situation that you don't really have any understanding of how other people are living, when you go out into the world and see how terribly the conditions, what terrible conditions other people are living in, that's a horrifying emotional experience. And when Emily begins to see that, she goes into the East End in London in the course of Crimson Warning and sees how the poor people are living and the circumstances in which they're working in these most hideous Victorian factories. She's absolutely taken aback because she didn't know that existed, and she immediately wants to do something about it.
And, you know, that's something that I think a lot of young people, you know, in today's day and age, young readers, don't really realize that you hit on, you know, which is the class system that happened,
mm-hmm.
you know, back in that time, and they really don't understand that. And do you get a lot of, you get a lot of email from younger generations saying, wow, I had no idea, or I had no idea about any of that stuff?
Well, I think people, they have a slight idea. They sort of know in theory that there was a class system, but it is very difficult for contemporary people to wrap their head around the idea that there were people who were so wealthy that they just lived in an absolute bubble. You know, it's not that they were even trying to be unenlightened. They didn't have the opportunity to be enlightened, especially women. Because, you know, men might be out in the world and allowed to read newspapers, but, you know, a lot of the ladies in Victorian England were so sheltered. They had no idea how the other half was living. And what I love is that you do get these women, these wealthy aristocratic women, who start to find out, and they make huge changes. You know, they've got money, which gives them power, and then they can start instigating social change. And you see it with the suffragettes, and you see it with other social justice, women who start campaigning for social justice. And that's what I want Emily to do. But I didn't, you know, it's the kind of thing that it's not reasonable to think that someone is going to, in the course of a day, go from living her sheltered existence to radically campaigning for change. And so I've been bringing her slowly along to this point. And in Crimson Warning, she's finally at that point where when she's seeing these differences, she's going to take radical action to do something about it.
And wrapped up in all of that is the mystery part. Murder,
right.
Mystery, things of those natures, which have to go on, which, again, maybe a lot of, you know, this is not set in today's technical age of, you know, cell phones, Facebook, computers, the whole nine yards. There's
right.
Nothing like that at all. And that's that's one thing that we've talked about before that
right.
Has to be the biggest challenge in writing is you're not using today's technical things. You have to use everything back then was all just very basic.
That's right. Because you don't have forensics in the way that you do now. And, you know, you just don't. The absence of cell phones, although sometimes I think that's a good thing.
It's a great thing. Oh,
right?
God, I hate cell phones.
But
yeah.
I know, I do too, right? But,
yeah.
You know, it's a very different. You have to rely on your wit in that kind of society because you can't. You know, I've once in a while, and I think we talked about this before, I've had moments where I'm getting to the denouement when I'm writing a manuscript, and I think, oh, can't she just blow something up? It would be so much easier.
Right.
But
yeah, that's what she said last time. Yeah.
She has to trick them, and she has to, you know, she has to win the battle of wits. She has to figure out a way to catch the bad guy that doesn't involve physically overpowering him.
Right, and that's the thing, you know, when you read maybe like some of the characters are out there now, I mean, you know, maybe they're martial art experts or they're snipers or anything to that nature where they always have that advantage, but the
right.
advantage that Emily has is mental, and so
right.
you have to dive into that character, which makes her expand that much further, and that's what you have focused on a lot when you're writing these books.
Exactly, and what I really also wanted to do with Crimson Warning, I mean, I don't want to give away the story, but
yeah.
I wanted when the reader gets to the point when he or she realizes who the bad guy is and why the bad guy is doing what the bad guy is doing, that you have sympathy for that person, that you think this person is right on a certain level. This person is exposing hypocrisy in this society, and somebody needs to be doing it. But of course, he's going too far. You know, you can't go around murdering people in a civilized society. But I
right.
really like to, you know, to think about that if you're going to condone a society that has these radical class differences, people living in poverty, people living in these gilded palaces with everything at their fingertips, you've got to expect that there is a price to be paid for that. And then
go ahead.
You know, you get the double standards in Victorian society where
yeah.
if you were wealthy and aristocratic, you could get away with virtually anything so long as you were more or less discreet about it. But if you didn't
right.
have that money and power, it was a whole different world for you, and that is just not fair.
And, you know, you kind of touched on something that was done, and I bet you've seen the movie, is V for Vendetta.
Yes.
Where he was technically the villain, but was he the villain? Because he was amping for change, just doing it in a visual anti-way
right.
that you just can't have.
Exactly, and that's the tricky thing, because I wanted with this book to have a villain, like I said, who you do have a certain measure of sympathy for, but then at the same time, you know that it just can't be like this.
Yeah.
Because you, in the end, you know, you do need law and order and civility for society to work.
And it's difficult to write a villain to where people can kind of go and say, oh, no, don't kill him. You know, I mean, I understand what he's
doing. Right.
I understand what he's doing.
Right.
Don't kill him.
right. Well, I always liked, I don't know if you ever read Dorothy L. Sayers, but, you know, her detective,
no.
Lord Peter Wimsey, you know, he's this gentleman, dilettante detective, but he's brilliant, and he, you know, can solve the cases that the police can't. But when, and she was writing in the 20s, and so in that period of time in England, you still had the death penalty. You still had capital punishment. And so Lord Peter gets the bad guy, and justice is served, and the bad guy is executed. You always have at the end of each of, I'm not going to say at the end of every one of them, but in, certainly in the end of a lot of them, you get a scene with Lord Peter at home feeling really bad about the fact that he is now responsible for the villain's death.
Oh.
Because even though that's justice, there's a way in which what he's doing, I mean, he's causing the death of someone the same way the villain did. And, you know, you can get into really interesting arguments about this. I mean, if you agree with capital punishment, fine. But, you know, when people murder someone, they think they're justified most of the time. They think they have a reason that makes this okay. And you know, there's a way in which what Sayers was saying with Lord Peter was that state-sanctioned execution is just socially acceptable murder, which I think is
correct. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, wherever you come down in the argument on that, it's still interesting to think about that. You know, I love that those scenes in her books where you've got Lord Peter sitting there, and he knows justice is served, and he's happy about that, but he can't feel good about causing the death of another human being.
Right. And, you know, the last time we talked was when you read Dangerous to Know, which was,
right.
You know, book 5 in the Lady Emily series. And like I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author Tasha Alexander, and the latest book is A Crimson Warning, book 6 in her Lady Emily series. But just going back, you know, from book 5 to 6 and
mm-hmm.
the progression of her, you know, what is the biggest kind of, you know, forward progression that Lady Emily has, you know, bringing from Dangerous to Know now to Crimson Warning that your
yeah.
fans are going to be able to expect?
Well, I think, first of all, she's recovered. In Dangerous to Know, she was recovering from physical injuries that she's sustained at the end of the fourth book. So she's over that. She's over the immediate emotional catastrophe of that. But more importantly, she and her husband have really at last come in their marriage to where they have a real understanding about the fact that they're both working on these things. And he is an agent for the Crown. He's used to being in dangerous situations. He's a very enlightened Victorian man, but he's still a Victorian man. So when they first got married, although he wanted this marriage of equals, he found that once he was actually in it, it was much harder than he thought it would be, because although it sounds great to be married to someone who's your equal, you might not feel that way when she's off doing something that's not recklessly dangerous, but that's necessarily dangerous. But by the time they've worked over the last couple of books, kind of pushed and pulled each other in regards to how much can she do and what's reasonable and what's not. But in Crimson Warning, they have at last settled on a real partnership. And they don't have to argue about, is it okay for her to do this? They finally come to an understanding in the relationship that makes it so they really are able to work together.
And, you know, when you're looking going forward here now into book 7 and things like that, do you think that, you know, those types of emotional bonds and those types of things that are just going to be more expanded on? Or, you know, do you kind of have an idea of where Lady Emily is going to be progressing now, you know, going forward
yeah.
in the future?
Well, I've finished book 7, so that my editor has already read it, and he loves it, thank God.
Good.
And it's set in Venice.
Okay.
And I think Emily and Colin work together beautifully in it. And, you know, because I want, you know, it's so tempting and easy to, if you've got a protagonist who's in a relationship, to use that relationship to get the tension for the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of push and pull and will they, won't they? And then once they're married, what do you do? I don't want to write books about people who can't get that figured out, you know?
Right. Right.
That's not the only source of tension in relationships. It's not the only source of tension in life. So the tension between the two of them isn't going to come from them doubting each other or you know, I just think there's a level on which it's kind of lazy writing when you rely too much on this. Oh, well, now they're going to have a fight, and he's going to go all protective, and she's going to be mad. And, you know, I don't like that. I don't like to keep relying on that. And so the tension in the seventh book really is all coming from external things, but they're going to work beautifully together, Emily and Colin.
So you really love the way that this that the seventh book kind of came together.
I did. You know, it was funny because I had the idea for the book. Well, actually, I mean, when I got married, Andrew and I, you know, my husband's a novelist as well, and we went to Venice for a honeymoon. I'd never been there. And as soon, I mean, actually, before I stepped off the boat, because, you know, you have to come into Venice via boat. And
right.
They're floating above you on the horizon, and it's just the most magical, beautiful sight. And I just thought, oh, I have to have a book set here. It's such an amazing place, but especially if you write historical fiction, because Venice hasn't changed. If you took a 16th century Venetian and plopped him down in St. Mark's Square today, he'd be able to find his way around. And so it was so fabulous to just really immerse myself in Venice. And, you know, you could just see the characters there, and you knew what Venice looked like back in the Renaissance. And so, in fact, in this next book, the primary story is Emily in the 1890s. But in order for her to solve the mystery in the present day, she has to figure out what happened back in the 15th century. So you have two storylines, one in the Renaissance and one in the 1890s.
And is it difficult for you to be able to find out, like, those little mysteries? Because, you know, like, cities like Venice and London and, you know, Paris, you know, they hold so many of those old mysteries back in those, you know, medieval Renaissance stuff that they could be sealed up or there's catacombs and things like that. But are you able to find those things out pretty easily?
You are, and it really varies from place to place. London is brilliant and frustrating simultaneously because large swathes of it, well, I mean, first of all, you've got enormous parts of the city that were destroyed during the Blitz.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you don't have these wonderful old Victorian buildings everywhere in London anymore. You've got a certain number of them, but a lot, you know, after the war, the rubble was pulled down and modern buildings were put up. So you can't necessarily say, I'm going to go back to Emily's London and I can just see what that looked like, because you can't necessarily. Now, with Venice, it's not like that. Venice wasn't bombed during the war. Venice, there are almost no modern buildings in Venice. You know, if you see an 18th century building in Venice, that's new. So it's much easier in Venice. Venice also has, which I learned when I was researching this next book, their city archives are unbelievable.
Wow.
They have records going back to, because Venice was an independent republic until the 19th century when it rolled into Italy. And the Venetian Republic kept records of everything. And so anything you want to know about who owned a house, who married who had done what, it's all there still. In fact, they have, I learned that they have, Venice has the second largest archive in the world, second only to the Vatican. The Vatican's is larger. But, you know, given the size of Venice, it's these a tiny little island. It's got this phenomenal resources if you want to do research about the history. But, you know, London has a lot of that, too. And I did, for Crimson Warning, I spent a lot of time working with people in the British Museum. And they were spectacular. And actually, and it breaks my heart, but there was a phenomenal research library in the British Museum that unfortunately has closed. They've closed it now because trying to, you know, cut austerity, right? So the library is shut down now. But that was an amazing resource for me when I was working on this book, you know, in terms of getting in and being able to see archival photographs and plans and, you know, that sort of thing. But alas, it is no longer. I mean, the British Library is fantastic and has got amazing resources.
So what people are able to do, well, basically what people are able to do then, they're able to get into the books able to get into Crimson Warning, and then able to do a little bit of homework on them, you know, on their own, and like you said, getting Book 7, going into Venice and doing those things, to be able to get a little more understanding of not only, you know, where you're coming from, but where Lady Emily is coming from,
yeah.
And to dive in more, to just, you know, to just get a better, not really better, just a more experience of the whole surrounding of all that time, because I always said if I could pick an era that I would like to have lived in, it would be like the medieval kind of Renaissance period. Now, I know I probably only lived till I was 38, but still, I would like to have experienced kind of that era. I mean, I love going to those Renaissance festivals.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's fantastic. You've got to go to Venice if you haven't gone to Venice. I mean, it's just
I haven't been to Europe.
Oh, you have to go to Venice.
Well,
yeah. In fact, when I was in Venice, I went twice to read. Well, I went once in June to do research for the book. And the last day I was there, they were doing a regatta, a reenactment of a Renaissance regatta, where Venice, Genoa, Pisa, and I think Padua. And they each had, or no, it was Amalfi, it wasn't Padua. And so they had Renaissance reproductions of boats, and they had this phenomenal procession from the Doge's Palace around St. Mark's Square with everyone dressed in these fabulous Renaissance costumes. And it was, it was just amazing because everything in the city physically looks the same, it really is like you're dropped back into the 15th century. It's amazing.
Yeah. That would be, you know, absolutely. And my wife, I'm sure, just heard you say that. So now she's probably going to be like, see, I told you. So I have to.
See, yeah, she's right. You have to go to Venice. You have to go to Venice. Well, in fact, I actually went and I wrote the bulk of the draft in Venice because I just,
it inspired you.
It really inspired me. It's just the kind of place that when you were there, I mean, I wrote like I've never written before. Just being there and soaking up that history. You can't, there's nothing that you can do to replace that.
Well, again, everybody, we're speaking here with Tasha Alexander, her website, TashaAlexander.com. The book is A Crimson Warning. And you got some events that you're going to be going to here. It looks like you're going to be out in New York and Arizona, Wisconsin and Texas and Florida. You know, you still like to do those kind of events. And how else can, you know, people maybe get in touch with you and, you know, email you to be able to, you know, maybe talk about the books and things like that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you can email me through my website. I do get it all. I can't always respond. You know, some of it's timing.
Sure.
Like if I'm under a deadline, I can't answer every single email, but, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter. And I do like touring still. It's so great to get to be able to meet readers and talk to them.
And
you know, writing is so isolating writing that when you get to get out and actually talk to readers, it's the best. It's just my favorite part.
Is there one particular kind of question or thing that always that always tends to come up that you always have to answer? And that you just want to say, okay, here's the answer to the question.
Well, you know what I would say the toughest bit is that contemporary readers, a lot of them, have really bought hook, line, and sinker the Edwardian's view of their stodgy Victorian grandparents. And so I'll get people who say, well, hang on, I don't think it's plausible that this woman would be off doing this, this, and that. But in fact, you know, my first step with research is to go straight to primary sources. I rely on diaries and memoirs and letters. And there were plenty of women, particularly in Victorian Britain, who were doing absolutely extraordinary things in the 19th century, things that today you'd be hard-pressed to get somebody to go do. They were courageous. They were not afraid of standing up against, you know, social oppression. They were not afraid of pissing off society. But it's funny to me how I think a lot of people have this view that history and the role of women has really been a linear progression, and it's not. You know, we are because it's the 21st century and we're in the United States doesn't mean that in every single way we have more freedom than some of these women did in generally more oppressive times. There have been extraordinary women during every period of history pushing the boundaries and working for change.
Well, I'll tell you what, Tasha, we definitely have to kind of meet up at a convention wherever, you know, we seem to miss each other. I don't know what it is. I know that we're going to be around like Left Coast Crime and Thriller Fest and maybe some other places, but it's been fabulous talking to you. I could literally sit and do this for an hour.
Me too. Well, we have to rendezvous. Maybe I'll go to Thriller Fest this year just so we can finally meet.
There we go. Yeah, because we'd love to go to Thriller Fest. And, you know, I don't know if you're going to think about Left Coast Crime in Sacramento or some other, because we like to try to stay around Los Angeles.
Sure.
Or try to, like, you know, just the West Coast, because it is a lot to kind of go out. But,
it'd
be great.
Yeah. Well, I will have to think about West Coast Crime, but maybe, you know, if nothing else, Thriller Fest. We need to have Thriller Fest back in Phoenix sometime.
Yeah, they're going to keep it in New York, I know, for a little bit. I think they're going to move it from the Hyatt, but I know that New York is where they're going to be because they have that big Asian Fest, and all those guys can just come right over for the Asian Fest.
Right.
That's always a huge thing.
It is,
But if you're ever in L.A., you look us up. We'll go out to dinner.
Oh, I definitely will. We'll go out to dinner.
And
you
can tell
my wife.
Yeah, you can tell my wife, make him take you to Venice.
That's right. See, what we need to do is next year, we need to be broadcasting live from Venice.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we can do that. I can do it anywhere. I can move it anywhere.
There we go. You see, it's all justified by work, you say.
Absolutely. That's true. And then I'll write it off.
That's right. Exactly. So, we have to have some perks, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I know. You don't get a lot. But, all right, Tasha, thank you so much for joining us today. And,
Thank you for having me.
We'll stay in touch, we'll talk, and, you know, we'll see each other soon.
That sounds great. Thanks so much, John.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay.
So, everybody, again, that was Tasha Alexander, best-selling author here, Book 6, Lady Emily, A Crimson Warning. Go get it. Go get all 5 and then get 6. Go get them all. Put them on the Kindle. Hand them out as Christmas presents. I'm telling you, if you have somebody who loves to read, they're going to love these books. It's going to be a great thing to pick up for Christmas, you know, especially if you're going to get them a Kindle, which is $79. Load it up, you know, with all 6 books here from Tasha Alexander. Not to mention, you can load it up with Jamie Frevoletti's books and then go get them. And John Rector, you know, you got them all right there. We've given you right now, you know, 10 books to go get on the Kindle to start reading. That's definitely going to take you, a great way to go start and, you know, great gift. So check that out. We will be here tomorrow live with the Halloween special at 9 a.m. You don't have to listen live because everything gets replayed, but you will be able to, you know, get that Halloween special. We're going to announce who we're going to read probably on Facebook later today, and we were going to be telling the people, you know, that their shows are, that their stories are going to be on the air. Check us out, suspensemagazine.com. Click on the Suspense Radio button to see when the next upcoming shows are. I believe our next live show is November the 19th. We have some fabulous authors coming up, I'm telling you. You don't want to miss them. You want to hear them here because there's no point going to Book Radio on Sirius because you're not going to hear crap over there. You're going to hear everything right here in Suspense Radio. Your favorite authors coming to you live right here. We will see you tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. on the Halloween special, and then back with you live for another great episode on November the 19th. So until then, I'm John Robb signing off. I will see you all there, suspensemagazine.com. Follow us on Facebook to get all the information on the behind the scenes on what's happening in your genre, suspense, mystery, thriller, horror. See you later, everybody.